Hey everyone, welcome to the podcast. I've got Kioxia with us today talking about all things Flash, and probably couldn't be more timely with the huge expansion in AI and other modern workloads. Thanks for getting in on the podcast. We're going to get to AI, but I want to start with some other things first. First of all, tell us a little about what you do at Kioxia and who you are.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me. My name is Maulik Sampura. I lead the product management team of SSDs at Kioxia Americas.
And that is a bigger and bigger job these days. I mean, in the early days of Flash, you had a couple models, and now the portfolio is unbelievably diverse. Like, when you think about managing SSDs, like, what's the hardest part with such a big portfolio these days?
That's a great question. Just the complexity of very fast-paced, rapid changes happening, especially with the AI boom. We are in a great time right now. You know, honestly, storage is at the forefront after, you know, if you think about GPUs and HBMs. So it's a great place to be. However, as you said, the complexity is growing immensely, and especially on the enterprise side, with hyperscalers' specific requirements, very custom requirements for their own needs. And they are obviously huge customers, so they demand certain things specifically for themselves. The form factors are growing like crazy. So, you know, we have so many form factors coming in, especially with, higher capacities. And now you see the liquid cooling coming in with Gen 6. So there are new changes happening for liquid cooling in terms of performance. You know, the GPUs are pushing the performance boundaries like anything we've seen before. And we are growing at an unprecedented pace. So, yes, it's a very challenging landscape right now.
So we are just coming off OCP. I didn't make it out there this year, but you're talking about hyperscalers. And it seems to me that historically, the hyperscalers have really dominated the direction of storage, if that makes sense. And I don't know that everyone really understands that. You know, the Metas of the world and Google and Amazon and all of these guys will say, you know, this is what we want out of a drive. Go build us a couple million of them. And then that really drives the direction for enterprise. Talk a little bit about maybe some of the benefits that the enterprise derives by hyperscalers sort of driving the performance and the form factors and whatever else you think is relevant there.
Yeah. So, yes, I was there at the OCP event this year. It has significantly grown. And now I see that event. It's like we are talking about very detailed storage stuff from all the way to data center, you know, even real estate, right? That and it has grown significantly in terms of data center infrastructure. So when I think one of the key things is the OCP specification itself. You know, when the hyperscaler started, then OEMs joined. The OCP specification is kind of honing everybody in one direction, and it's simplifying at least all the stuff that we used to do in silos. And, you know, there were lots of changes which firmware had to accommodate and we had to validate. So now having one specification on top of the NVMe specification helps a great deal, even to the enterprise customers. There are minor changes. Enterprise customers specifically, they sell from, you know, point of sale all the way to the data center. So their requirements still could be much bigger in that scope. They have to kind of address a single customer versus a gigantic, you know, small customer compared to a CSP. So in that regards, there might be changes. They do require certain stuff that, you know, for example, 3 drive writes per day, you know, is one example, right? So what those things are different, but otherwise it does help overall to get into the same space from specification. And I think as an industry, it's coming together even for form factors, as I said. You know, while there are, you know, it's there's a wide gamut of form factors, I think industry is coming together slowly to kind of, you know, reduce that. Everybody's worried about the increased number of SKUs.
Yeah, I mean, you hit on a couple things. You hit on performance. You know, that could be a couple level of SKUs. You hit on form factors. That could be, I mean, at this point, a dozen different form factors that when we start factoring in all the EDSFF variations and the thicknesses, Z height. And then you've got endurance, which you didn't get to yet, but I'm sure we will, which is another factor. And as you slide all those knobs around, you could end up with a difficult portfolio to wrangle with too many options. But it sounds like if you feel like at least, I mean, in the enterprise, I think we've seen it already, right? Yeah. We still have a little bit of U.2, you know, hanging around, but E3S seems like the way most modern servers and then eventually storage appliances will go to. I'm sure that's consistent with what you're seeing. But what else are you seeing in terms of thinning down the varieties of form factors?
That's always a question. In fact, I'm going to Japan next week, and that's one of the discussions, right? Internally, of course, we are talking to the external customers for all of these, but we have even.L, we have different varieties of even.S. Now, liquid cool is joining that E3S, 1T, 2T. So far, 2T, very few, you know, almost, you know, non-existent. Mm-hmm. And then we have 2.5 inch, as you mentioned. So 2.5 inch will still continue. But Gen 6, as you said, people are moving to E3S 1T. And I think that's the right direction in terms of power and thermals. That's where we are making progress. And, you know, we are recommending customers to kind of move toward E3S to align as an industry. So we are semi-successful, I would say. There's a lot of legacy stuff and people still want certain things. And plus, these things run very long, right? So people have to support for 5 years, 7 years. So yeah, I'm hoping that by Gen 6 and Gen 7, you know, we kind of come to a much smaller number of form factors and SKUs.
Yeah, I know. It's funny, though. As soon as you say that, I mean, we were just writing not long ago about E2, which is another one, which is unbelievable. And if, you know, for people that don't know, this is a much larger physical SSD, really designed for capacity. And I don't know that it's in the mission, but it, you know, I think of it as maybe the true hard drive replacement form factor and capacity and performance profile. But was that a popular topic at OCP this year?
Yes. There were a couple of discussions on E2. And, you know, the way they designed E2 is very clever. So we are using the same connector, same height as E3. It's just that instead of E3L, it's longer. But it also is slightly thicker. So when you look at like front-mounted SSDs, you know, it's basically, you can't use the same slots that you build for E3S because this is now 9.5 millimeter thick instead of 7. And therefore you still have to design your, you know, design a different chassis to take advantage of that. And it's longer. So, you know, if you have components in the backside, you have to shift everything, you know, but it does allow you to reach to huge capacity. So in the future, if we have 4 terabit die, for example, or, you know, and you can go much higher in stacks, then you can go up to 1 petabyte just on a drive.
That's amazing. I mean, we saw some people concerned about, you know, things like blast radius and rebuild and whatever, as we went from even just 4 to 8 terabytes and 8 to 16. And now that 122 has been shipping for a while, you guys have announced a 245 class drive already. I think fundamentally just comes down to needing to build systems that are more intelligent, more resilient, so that we can eat a byte drive loss and not lose availability or whatever the QoS, the performance guarantee is in that particular system, right?
Yes. Yeah, so that's a great point, actually. So I think what has happened in the last, you know, I think a decade, especially the CSPs, the hyperscalers, they are taking these large density drives. And you touched upon LC9, the 245 SKU that we announced. That was purposefully built for large-scale repositories and data lakes. And the primary driver is rack consolidation and power efficiency, right? And so when you look at from a RAID rebuild, you mentioned blast radius and RAID rebuild. What hyperscalers are doing is, you know, they are sharding the data. So the data is, you know, very small chunks, you know, and distributed across many storage devices. They are doing erasure coding across the racks. They are also now with smart monitoring, latency monitoring, you know, there are so many tools for predictive analysis so that before the drive goes bad, they decommission and replace the drive so that they don't have to deal with the failure. And even the locations, they are separately located and, you know, they can build. You can also build with multiple drives now instead of rebuilding just, you know, through few drives, right? So in general, you are actually accelerating the rebuild times. And, you know, if you compare today's, say, 30 terabyte HDD versus a 245 terabyte SSD, so I can, you know, it's even at Gen 4 speeds, right? Your read speeds are 7,000 megabytes a second. So you could build a 245 roughly in, say, 1.5 hours versus a 30 terabyte hard disk drive will take about 5 hours. So not only you have 6 times the capacity, you know, you are almost 4 times faster, three and a half times. So you're almost 20x faster in rebuild times also. So yes, there is obviously a concern. And I think the other way to think about it is 2 terabyte drive. If I'm giving you 5-year warranty and 2.5 million MTBF for a 2 terabyte drive, and same for 245 terabyte, from a reliability point of view, you are still getting the same reliability underneath. So on top of having all of these provisions, I think now the blast radius concerns have kind of significantly come down. But for OEMs, as we touched upon earlier, there may be some concerns for point of sale and stuff like that. But in general, I think at least at a large deployment, it's much, much better handled.
So speaking of large deployments, you hit on liquid cooling a couple times. And I want to visit that because we're seeing that in a number of different ways. But I suppose the NVL72 or the GB300 nodes now are really what's pushing that from the AI training perspective at a large scale with the E1S drives. What are you seeing there that's interesting? Or what do you have to do as Kioxia to be ready for big shifts like that in technology?
Yeah, so we have been participating in the standards, which is the SNIA SFF was driving that. And so we've provided some comments to improve certain things. But primarily, the idea is to have the secondary and primary sides and the top and the bottom, which are the thinner sides of the E1.S. And, you know, the idea is to have one side cold plate from the host. And you change the, you know, there are minor changes so that we have the right connection for thermal conductivity, right? So in that regards, there are changes in the material, the tooling. You know, you need certain flatness and roughness, and some of the customers wanted like a chamfer around the connector. Some customers may use TIM material. Some customers may not use TIM material. So we kind of helped the industry, you know, and tried to say, hey, you know, there are certain things we need to kind of do it this way. But otherwise, I think we will be ready at, you know, we'll start with Gen 5 drives and then go to Gen 6. Because, you know, the Gen 5 will be our POC, like, hey, whoever is deploying Gen 5, even in Gen 6, because some customers are going liquid cooled, whether it's Gen 5 or Gen 6, it's like, you know, whatever drive, it has to be liquid cooled. So So we will start with Gen 5 and then move to Gen 6.
Okay. So that, I mean, that makes sense for the big training systems, of course. If we can get fans out of those, get those to be more efficient. You know, we all know the reports of how much power AI is consuming these days. And I think it's generally, you know, by most, sort of underappreciated how much electricity, obviously the GPUs, but the fans to cool the GPUs and to cool the system use up a tremendous amount of power. So there should be some good savings there. Do you see that as you look down the road translating to the enterprise market? Obviously, we've seen systems from Dell and HPE and Lenovo and Supermicro. They're all using liquid cooling to different extents. But the enterprise is just a little more reluctant than most that are putting in these training clusters to rework their data center and bring in water. In some cases, they can't do it. Others, they don't want to do it. But it seems like for next-gen systems, we might be getting so close to the benefits of fully liquid cooling these systems from a power consumption standpoint that it may just tip the balance. You know, what do you see in the enterprise world?
Yeah, that is very true observation, Brian. What we are seeing is, especially on the E1.S, most of the companies are following the NVIDIA direction and, you know, going with this liquid cool design on E1.S. But on the OEM front, where they are using external boxes, you know, E3S takes precedent. And now we are talking about E3S because the connector can go much higher in terms of, you know, it allows for a lot more power. Especially with Gen 6, we would need more power than 25 watts if you want to saturate certain corners, and especially on the right side. So therefore, you know, they are looking at liquid cooling on the E3S side as well. And that's also being discussed. So in the industry overall, I think that's going to be a de facto standard going forward.
Yeah, I think OCP has a couple working groups for liquid cooling, both direct to plate and then a separate whole chain for immersion, which is another place we've spent a lot of time. But, you know, the storage impact there is a totally different set of concerns, which is interesting in its own right. Those working groups must be fun to be part of too, because we're just in this shift in data center technology that's so dramatic that really we haven't seen this in a very long time, maybe even since Flash first came into the data center.
I agree. AI is basically changing a lot of things that we had and an incredible pace also, right? As you said, unprecedented pace that we are picking up, and things are changing so rapidly. But what we have, at least on the AI side of things, from a storage perspective, right? When you look at AI workflows and AI infrastructure, we feel that two vectors will be dominating for storage. One is capacity and one is performance. Mm-hmm. And capacity is where, you know, we basically announced the 245 terabyte, first 245, and that we did with first two terabit QLC die with an innovative 32 die stack on the NAND. So that's, everything is first time, right? We never built 32 die stack. We never built a 2 terabit die. We never built a 245 terabyte drive. We never built an E3L form factor. So there's a lot of changes coming very rapidly at us, yes. And now, you know, compounded with PCIe interfaces. You know, the cadence is much faster because of GPUs.
Well, and it's kind of fun too, because the storage really isn't the bottleneck anymore. I mean, there's different ways to look at it within the GPU system, whether it's a traditional rack server or, you know, those NVL nodes. The storage is typically fast enough to keep up with the GPU's ability to process data. But when we look at some of these real dense boxes, we're doing some work on a system now with 24 drives, 4 lanes. The ability to generate, you know, 250, 280 gig a second in that box is stunning in itself.
Yes.
But now if we want to take that box and share it out to 6 or 8 or 10 GPU servers, now we got a problem. problem, sort of, right? In that we can only go as fast as the network will let us go. I mean, the storage boxes have gotten very, very good, and the drives inside, and now it's a fabric issue of how many NICs can we get into this box to share it to all these hungry servers. Data transport's not really your problem, but what's your view on fabric these days?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the nail there. It's so for, you know, all, if you look at all the large deployments where all the money is being spent, right, they are spending a lot of money to kind of solve that problem also. Because, you know, every bottleneck, right, once is GPU, then HBM, then storage, then, you know, everything down the pipeline has to kind of meet the requirements. And therefore, that is why the scale of money and amount of, you know, dollars being spent, CapEx, and even OpEx, right, this huge, we've never seen this kind of investment overall in the data center at this rapid scale, at this scale and this speed. Mm-hmm. And so... I think that is being solved, you know, and if you see the Ethernet guys are coming out with 800 native, you know, and so on, and, you know, the smart NICs are getting much smarter, faster, CX8, CX9, NVIDIA is coming out with all those. So, you know, when you look at it, I think from a big picture point of view, that is being solved. From a smaller customers, yes, that is a challenge, right? So how do you scale, and now, you know, you have to make sure that the cost is also, you know, balanced, right?
Right.
So 100 gig, 200 gigs, maybe 400. So I see it solved at a grand scale, but I think there will be a lot of like middle tier and lower tier that still needs to kind of come up to that. And I don't think we are there yet. So that's a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, AI is obviously driving that, but the good old fiber channel networks are still going to exist, and we're still going to have databases. Can you imagine that? I mean, this is about the longest I've ever gone without talking about database performance. I assume you still have customers that care about that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, especially vector databases, right?
You had to bring it back to AI.
Huh? Well, no, I know what you mean. But
yeah. Well, so there's another thing that I think is interesting about Kioxia, and this may be a hair outside of your wheelhouse, but you guys are doing a lot in software too, and open sourcing some projects. And I'm not sure the industry really knows that much about what you're doing on the software side. Again, I know it's probably a little outside your scope, but just give us some of the high level beats on your view of software and some of the open source work you guys are doing.
Yeah. So a couple of things. There is a group called Storage Pathfinding Group. And so we have a senior fellow, Rory Bolt, who's managing that group. And he was in the software side of things before also in Kioxia when we had the software-defined storage. And primarily right now we are focusing on Isaac. You may have seen the demos and or some videos where what we are trying to do is what can we achieve in terms of performance without the DRAM required? How can we reduce the cost of the expensive HBM? And so Microsoft had a Disk ANN, which was a software which would utilize this. And what we did was we took that and added our own recipe to reduce that significantly. So now, you know, I don't remember the numbers on top of my head, but basically, Isaac is reducing the DRAM to almost bare bones and still get the same performance. There are minor things that may come up in terms of latency, but otherwise it's significantly improved. And so that's a huge cost savings for the customers.
Yeah, and you've got some, I think some RocksDB work too, or something else that's kind of interesting.
Right.
But it does, you know, sort of highlight how you guys are taking a multifaceted view toward, you know, whatever the problems are you're helping customers solve. And then there's the whole fab side. So you're headed over to Japan, I think you said, and that's got to be pretty thrilling to be able to see those fabs and the wafers rolling off the line. You know,
yes.
Do they like you in there at all?
I have been to Yokkaichi before. This time, no, mostly I go for strategic discussions and mostly for the product roadmap and strategy discussions. But yeah, I don't plan to go this time. But yes, it's fascinating to see those wafers. And we have Kitakami, which we announced with SanDisk recently, where K2 is also ready for production. So yeah, we are growing and we are very excited.
Talk about that piece of it for a moment, because I think there have been some concerns about supply. We went through the COVID cycle where, you know, supply got diminished and then maybe came back and we overbuilt or overproduced. And now it feels like we're sort of in an in-between. For plenty of people tell me that supplies are maybe even a year out at this point for large orders. For some vendors anyway, I don't know. But what is going on with supply and what can customers expect, at least from your perspective?
Yeah, that's a $1 million question right now. So
more than that.
$1 billion question maybe. So we talk to the analysts, we talk to the customers, we talk to the suppliers, and the shortage is real. We all see it. What's happening in the industry is, as you say, when COVID hit and we, you know, there was a lot of inventory, you know, it was a huge downturn for the industry. And as an industry, we lost $30 billion on the flash side, SSD side. So after that, and let me say that when we go to BiCS8, BiCS9, BiCS10, you know, as we ramp the technology, and similar for our competitors, you know, as you scale the layers or reduce, the lithography, your cost of the CapEx is increasing very, very rapidly and huge. Like before it was, you know, it used to be 2-year NAND cycle. Now, you know, this is changing rapidly. And also that just to keep up with that kind of speed and increase the capacity, reduce the cost. While it's a great opportunity for the storage industry, it's also, you know, there is always that that fear that, hey, what if the downturn comes again? And I feel that the storage industry will be cautious to kind of grow, but it will grow. You know, the trajectory is upwards, but how much each vendor kind of can do more, and how much fab capacity do they have idle today, or can they increase anything in terms of ramping up the production? That has to be seen. But yes, it's going to be interesting to see how we, you know, as a lot of analysts say that this is a super cycle. So compared to, you know, the regular standard cycle, this is a super cycle. And if we believe that, this could take, you know, maybe another 4 or 5 years. It could last for that. Or more, I don't know. But, you know, not a typical 1.5-2 year cycle, right? In that case, it'll be interesting.
Yeah, it certainly feels like we're in something, you know, a super cycle maybe, but with AI becoming more productive and more real for more organizations, no one's going to delete data. So all we're going to do is keep creating data, keep stacking data, and then now we've got to figure out where to put it, what these new tiers, you know, what we used to call data lakes. I mean, that's even shifting the way organizations are thinking about availability of data and where AI is run. I mean, we've even seen backup repositories being targets for running AI against them for, you know, non-critical, non-real-time kind of things. But wherever the data is, I think we might see some of the AI get pushed at the data. I mean, we've seen that already at Edge. I mean, how many smart cities, you know, conversations have we had, right? Where it's getting more tech into the edge devices so that they more work in robotics, more work in other industries where even a little NPU or something can bring a lot of analysis and insight to data. But slowing that down the storage market, I don't see that at this point. Yeah. I think it's a question of where is the spend going to go? What is the flash and hard drive spend, you know, mix look like? And, you know, do we start to get closer with these big drives that we've been talking about to really disrupting the hard drive market? I mean, I'm sure you'd like to take a swing at that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Most definitely. Actually, if you, I was just looking at 245 terabyte that we announced, right? And if you look at a 42U rack, you can fit about, say 10 drives per U and 420 drives of 245, just for the calculation of, you know, how that will. So that's a 100 petabyte rack, 103 petabyte rack. Mm. If I take that and compare to today's 30 terabyte HDD, you would need 7 racks. And now you need the additional networking, the switches, everything. So if I compare, the biggest challenge, as you touched upon earlier, with all the GPUs and the power being a big constraint, what's happening is GPUs are taking more and more power. You know, and NVIDIA and others are, you know, they want to cram more GPUs per box. Okay. So NVL72, 144, now you're looking at bigger and bigger numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge is, you know, power has to come from somewhere. You know, the data center pipeline is fixed. So while you can build bigger data centers with more power and so on, what are you going to do about today's power? So now you're also going to liquid cooling. So the power reduction could be a huge benefit if you go to SSDs, right? So in this case, right, where you have 42U, 100 petabyte rack, and 7 racks of hard drives, you IOPS per watt is almost 1300x. And wow. While they are increasing, while HDDs are increasing to fit more spindles to, you know, get the capacity, now you're, you know, most likely 30 to say 40 and then 50. But even with 30 terabyte, your performance is not growing, right? So performance density is a huge problem. There's no scaling there. So IOPS per gigabyte, right, even with 245, which is a huge denominator to have it in the at the bottom, yeah, even that is still 600x better. And then your throughput is 7 to 8 times better. So overall TCO is huge improvement.
Yeah, we've seen those charts, right? And yeah, and the efficiency numbers that you talk about, and just the raw growth of data. I think there for many that table will flip, and yeah, there won't be any other choice. We talked a lot about OCP and hyperscalers driving the industry, but now we're coming up on sunny St. Louis and Supercompute 25, which is going to be an interesting one. I'm not sure St. Louis is ready for this. I went to the first Supercompute after COVID that they had there, and it was okay, but it was only a couple thousand people. This, I've heard from dozens of people that have to stay 20 or 30 minutes away from the convention center. We're at 4 different hotels just for our organization. It's going to be wild, but people seem really excited for it. I'm sure you guys will have several people there as well. What do you look forward to from, you know, what the HPC world can teach us next in terms of where technology is going?
Yeah, that's that is very interesting. We did attend the last few supercomputing events. One was, I think last time was Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And this time it's St. Louis, so we will be there. And I think in most cases, in especially in the supercomputing, we are there to listen. You know, we are there to learn, especially with Cray and, you know, like the supercomputing giants, right? Where, what are they doing, right? If you think about today, like, you know, compare it with 20 years ago, you know, now you are having supercomputing in, you know, multiples of racks. You know, literally your GPUs are so powerful that now you're just like, you know, supercomputers all together. But we go to listen. We, you know, specifically we talk to the customers, we talk, you know, attend the sessions and learn what the new technologies from a thermal point of view, cooling point of view, performance, what are the pain points, right? What are the solutions that they are bringing? So yeah, generally it's more of a, you know, absorbing things from the industry and see, you know, how we can help in the standards perspective or say SSD feature or a performance point of view. But yeah, nothing specific, but mostly learning on all the stuff that is going around.
I mean, but I don't know about all your customers, but most of your non-hyperscale customers will be there. All the server vendors, all the storage guys, the ones, the big ones, Weka and Vast and DDN and all those guys that are quite popular at shows like this. Because again, we're back to some of the conversation we've already had, feeding these large clusters and scheduling time on them and scheduling access to data. I mean, there just becomes this orchestration of data movement becomes really important to this audience is what I expect we'll hear more of when that show comes up.
Agreed. I think that it is growing. As you said, the popularity is growing, and I see the OEM customers, and now I'm seeing hyperscale customers also having a big presence there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and rightly so, right? It's more of, you've seen announcements from Google on the quantum computing. They, even on the large language models, last month they announced that they hit quadrillion tokens in a month. So, which is, you know, this kind of scale requires new, because there are also, even if from supercomputing, I think there is a chance to kind of derive something goodness in your, you know, standard computing also. So there's also that hope that it kind of intermingles, yeah.
Well, that's why I like personally OCP and supercompute so much, because you get a vision into where the enterprise will end up. You know, we'd like to think, I think, that the OEMs have a lot of discretion in the systems they build. They do, of course, but it is so greatly influenced by what's happening outside that world and at the hyperscalers. Even things like form factor, I mean, 21-inch servers are the OCP standard now, and things like busbar, and like there's all this other technology that will start to feed into the way enterprise servers are designed and really make data center designers and IT admins and everyone that's involved in the acquisition process of any of these systems has got to be juggling so many balls and thinking about so many different challenges. It is not as simple as it used to be, and it will continue to be, you know, a big diversity in technology, I think. Yeah.
Yes, completely agree. You know, I attended OCP, and I don't know if you probably saw the Meta keynote. And the VP, I think his name is Dan, he was explaining the you know, they have that ORV3, the wide rack. So now they have the ORV3 wide, and now they're talking about even bigger racks. And they're talking about special, like, trolley and tools made for that rack, because there's nothing. This is like an elephant. It's like one big elephant. Just to move that thing around is also another challenge. And they are obviously doing through OCP. So this is like open source. You know, you can do this. And you talked about bus bars. We are talking about this 800 volt, 800. You know, it's just getting crazy. And everybody will benefit from that, as you said. You know, when OEMs and hyperscales get together, it's kind of solving each other's problems together, hopefully, as an industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, they're after infinite resiliency, right? And I think that's also important at the enterprise. We've talked about the nines forever, 5, 6, 7, all of the nines. So that's clearly the directive. Well, this has been fun. I appreciate you hopping in, and I think you have done a good job to articulate a lot of the benefits and things that you guys are working on, the 245, the software advancements, the some of the thoughts on Liquid. I mean, these are all important topics that I think our audience will take, you know, great joy from getting your perspective. So thanks for that. I appreciate you hopping on today.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me. Pleasure's mine.